Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, we will bring you the first part of the story A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs in our program, American Stories. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Donald Trump became the first serving American president to meet with a North Korean leader in June 2018. Trump's talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore led to an agreement in which the two nations promised to keep working on several issues aimed at improving relations. Trump and Kim held another face-to-face meeting last month in Vietnam. That meeting produced no major agreements. At both meetings, the leaders reportedly considered a proposal to open a liaison office in North Korea's capital, Pyongyang. Such offices are one step below an embassy. They are often set up between nations that do not have official diplomatic relations. They offer a way for two nations that have tense relations to continue some kind of working contact. The U.S. has operated interest sections in places like Cuba and Iran. South Korea set up a liaison office in the North Korean city of Kaesong last year after several months of increased discussions and contacts with the North. If the U.S. and North Korea decide to open a liaison office, Sweden says it will make a room available for that purpose. The room sits next to the Swedish ambassador's office in Pyongyang's diplomatic area. The room has remained mostly unused for more than 20 years. But it was once used as an office to handle U.S.-North Korean matters. The office was set up after an agreement signed in 1995 that gave Sweden permission to serve as America's protective power in North Korea. At the time, there were a lot of talks going on between U.S. and North Korean officials. The office was meant to serve as a base for necessary contacts because the U.S. had no diplomatic relations with the North. Entering the room today, reports say there is evidence of the changing relationship of the two sides over the years. Two versions of the Pyongyang Times newspaper are on display. One reports on warming relations under North Korea's late leader Kim Jong-il and U.S. President Bill Clinton during the 1990s. A more recent issue of the newspaper shows a photo of Trump and Kim Jong-un on its front page. Trump and Kim were asked by reporters about the possibility of opening a liaison office during their meeting last month in Hanoi, Vietnam. "It's actually not a bad idea," Trump said. Kim answered through an interpreter, saying, "I think that is something that could be welcomed." Sweden permitted a reporter from the Associated Press to see the room set aside for possible U.S. use. The reporter, however, was not permitted to take pictures for security reasons. One diplomat told the AP the office could be used as an interest section for the U.S. This would be one step below a liaison office. The Swedish embassy in Pyongyang, along with the British embassy, sits on the property of the German embassy. Diplomats said if the U.S. does decide to set up a liaison office, Sweden would no longer be responsible for U.S. interests in North Korea under the current agreement. I'm Brian Lynn.
Faces of Immigrants in paintings by artist Betsy Ashton look the viewer directly in the eye. The subjects of these life-size paintings seem ready to tell their stories of leaving home to face the problems of living in a strange land. Ashton says she created the oil paintings to answer what she calls a false political narrative about immigrants in the United States. Her artworks can be seen at an exhibit called Portraits of Immigrants at the Riverside Church in New York City. The show ends April 21st. About 16 kilometers south from the church is Ellis Island, where 12 million newcomers landed from 1892 to 1954. On a nearby island stands the Statue of Liberty. A sign on the statue reads, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." The subjects of the portraits are from Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, and Europe. They include teachers, business people, a healthcare worker, housekeeper, actor, politician, and coffee shop employee. Some are U.S. citizens. Others have proper documents, although one does not. Ashton is a former news reporter. She wrote a short description of each immigrant and then put up the information next to each portrait. The stories tell of struggling to get used to a new culture and learning a new language for the promise of a better life. One picture shows Ron Kim in his New York State Assembly office. He represents part of Queens, one of New York's five districts. Kim came to New York from South Korea when he was six. He says, "It is showing the group of immigrants as a whole that makes the portraits more powerful." Another immigrant honored in oil paint is Abdul Sabur, who taught U.S. troops the culture of his native Afghanistan before coming to the United States nearly 5 years ago. Sabur is now a U.S. citizen and works for the upstate New York nonprofit group that helped resettle him. He sees Ashton's art show as one way for Americans to imagine themselves in my skin. Both Kim and Sabur said they are very mindful of the political debate over immigration since Donald Trump became president. As a candidate in 2016, Trump talked about bad people coming from Mexico and said he wanted to build a wall on the U.S. southern border. As president, Trump has continued to talk about illegal immigrants and has limited their pathways for legal immigration and travel. The Reuters News Service says the Trump administration did not answer its request for comment on this story. Ashton told Reuters that a story she heard at a religious service made her decide to start making her paintings. She started with Eddie Rigo, who operates a coffee shop she visits each morning. He fled crime-ridden Sao Paulo, Brazil, where his Italian family had been in the pizza business. Then came Bida Sakowicz-Kumbel, a healthcare worker Ashton knows from doctor visits. She left Poland's struggling economy in the early 1990s. The art collection grew to 16 people. Ashton wants to find two more immigrants from troubled countries to complete the set. The subjects include a woman called Angel, who came to the United States on a tourist visa 20 years ago. She does not have legal documents to stay in the country. Another painting shows Maria Salome, a Guatemalan housekeeper who came across the Rio Grande River, but recently got legal documents to stay. Another painting shows John Lam, who was poor when he arrived from Hong Kong. He now heads the Lam Group Real Estate Investment Company. Ashton said the immigrants have many different ancestries, races, and religions, but they all are fighting to solve the problems that made them leave their homes. I'm Jill Robbins.
New Zealand is 3 years into what many consider to be the world's largest animal protection program. The Predator-Free 2050 government program has a goal of removing all non-native pests by the year 2050 to protect the country's native wildlife. One area on New Zealand's South Island has not heard the sounds of native birds in years. This is because of predator pests, including possums, rats, and stoats. Dave Butler is the head of the Brook Waimarama Sanctuary near the city of Nelson. He directed a program that dropped poison from a helicopter, which killed pests in the sanctuary area. This permitted native animals to increase in number once again.
We saw the first sort of season after the pest removal, big increases in some of the common birds here, the tuis and the fantails and so on.
The sanctuary was completed in September 2016. It takes 7 hours to walk around the pest-free area. Butler says there are plans to expand the project.
We've got the opportunity of working back into the city from here, some 10 minutes drive away, and bringing these amazing birds back into people's gardens. And then this way, we've sort of got 100,000 hectares of native forest to start restoring and bringing that back. And that all ties into the very exciting, challenging vision the country has of predator-free 2050.
Butler added that settlers who arrived in New Zealand introduced animals such as rats, possums, and stoats that put native wildlife at risk. Sky Davies is the manager of Tasman Environmental Trust. She said she does not love the idea of killing animals, but she sees it as a necessary step toward saving New Zealand's native species.
So if we want to save species that are only found in New Zealand, nowhere else in the world, the unfortunate fact is that we need to kill these predators that are causing their demise.
But some people consider the Predator-Free 2050 project to be problematic. Jamie Steer is a senior biodiversity advisor at the Greater Wellington Regional Council. He said he does not expect the program to work.
One of my biggest issues with Predator Free 2050 is that it sets up public expectations that it just can't possibly live up to. It creates the impression that the removal of just 5 introduced mammals will be a game changer for conservation in New Zealand, when it would actually be nothing of the sort.
Still, hundreds of community conservation projects and science and environmental agencies have joined the government's war on pests.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Today, we begin a new series from a book by American writer Edgar Rice Burroughs. The book is called A Princess of Mars. It is the first book in a series that Mr. Burroughs wrote about a man who travels to Mars during the last years of the 1800s. There, the man meets strange beings and sees strange sights. At first, he is a captive, then a warrior, and after many battles, a prince of a royal family. Shep O'Neill begins the story of A Princess of Mars.
I am a very old man. How old, I do not know. It is possible I am 100, maybe more. I cannot tell, because I have never aged as other men do. So far as I can remember, I have always been a man of about 30. I appear today as I did 40 years ago. Yet, I feel that I cannot go on living forever. Someday, I will die the real death from which there is no escape. I do not know why I should fear death, I, who have died 2 times, and am still alive. I have never told this story. I know the human mind will not believe what it cannot understand. I cannot explain what happened to me. I can only tell the 10 years my dead body lay undiscovered in an Arizona cave. My name is John Carter. I am from the state of Virginia. At the close of the Civil War, I found myself without a home, without money, and without work. I decided the best plan was to search for gold in the great deserts of the American Southwest. I spent almost a year searching for gold with another former soldier, Captain James Powell, also of Virginia. We were extremely lucky. In the winter of 1865, we found rocks that held gold. Powell was trained as a mining engineer. He said we had uncovered over $1 million worth of gold in only 3 months. But the work was slow, with only 2 men and not much equipment. So we decided Powell should go to the nearest settlement to seek equipment and men to help us with the work. On March 3rd, 1866, Powell said goodbye. He rode his horse down the mountain toward the valley. I followed his progress for several hours. The morning Powell left was like all mornings in the deserts of the great Southwest, clear and beautiful. Not much later, I looked across the valley. I was surprised to see three riders in the same place where I had last seen my friend. After watching for some time, I decided the three riders must be hostile Indians. Powell, I knew, was well-armed and an experienced soldier, but I knew he would need my aid. I found my weapons, placed a saddle on my horse, and started as fast as possible down the trail taken by Powell. I followed as quickly as I could until dark. About 9 o'clock, the moon became very bright. I had no difficulty following Powell's trail. I soon found the trail left by the three riders following Powell. I knew they were Indians. I was sure they wanted to capture Powell. Suddenly, I heard shots far ahead of me. I hurried ahead as fast as I could. Soon, I came to a small camp. Several hundred Apache Indians were in the center of the camp. I could see Powell on the ground. I did not even think about what to do. I just acted. I pulled out my guns and began shooting. The Apaches were surprised and fled. I forced my horse into the camp and toward Powell. I reached down and pulled him up on the horse by his belt. I urged the horse to greater speed. The Apaches, by now, realized that I was alone and quickly began to follow. We were soon in very rough country. The trail I chose began to rise sharply. It went up and up. I followed the trail for several hundred meters more until I came to the mouth of a large cave. It was almost morning now. I got off my horse and laid Powell on the ground. I tried to give him water, but it was no use. Powell was dead. I laid his body down and continued to the cave. I began to explore the cave. I was looking for a safe place to defend myself, or perhaps for a way out, but I became very sleepy. It was a pleasant feeling. My body became extremely heavy. I had trouble moving. Soon, I had to lay down against the side of the cave. For some reason, I could not move my arms or legs. I lay facing the opening of the cave. I could see part of the trail that had led me here. And now, I could see the Apaches. They had found me, but I could do nothing. Within a minute, one of them came into the cave. He looked at me, but he came no closer. His eyes grew wide. His mouth opened. He had a look of terror on his face. He looked behind me for a moment and then fled. Suddenly, I heard a low noise behind me. So could the rest of the Apaches. They all turned and fled. The sound became louder, but still I could not move. I could not turn my head to see what was behind me. All day, I lay like this. I tried again to rise, and again, but I still could not move. Then I heard a sharp sound. It was like a steel wire breaking. I quickly stood up. My back was against the cave wall. I looked down. There before me lay my body. For a few moments, I stood looking at my body. I could not bring myself to touch it. I was very frightened. The sounds of the cave and the sight of my body forced me away. I slowly backed to the opening of the cave. I turned to look at the Arizona night. I could see 1,000 stars. As I stood there, I turned my eyes to a large red star. I could not stop looking at it. It was Mars, the red planet, the red god of war. It seemed to pull me near. Then, for a moment, I closed my eyes. There was an instant of extreme cold and total darkness. Suddenly, I was in deep, dreamless, peaceful sleep. I opened my eyes upon a very strange land. I immediately knew then I was on Mars. Not once did I question this fact. My mind told me I was on Mars, as your mind tells you that you are upon Earth. You do not question the fact, nor did I. I found myself lying on a bed of yellow-colored grass that covered the land for kilometers. The time was near the middle of the day, and the sun was shining full upon me. It was warm. I decided to do a little exploring. Springing to my feet, I received my first Martian surprise. The effort to stand carried me into the Martian air to the height of about 1 meter. I landed softly upon the ground, however, without incident. I found that I must learn to walk all over again. My muscles were used to the gravity of Earth. Mars has less gravity. My attempts to walk resulted in jumps and hops, which took me into the air. I once landed on my face. I soon learned that it took much less effort for me to move on Mars than it did on Earth. Near me was a small, low wall. Carefully, I made my way to the wall and looked over. It was filled with eggs, some already broken open. Small, green creatures were in them. They looked at me with huge red eyes. As I watched the fierce-looking creatures, I failed to hear 20 full-grown Martians coming from behind me. They had come without warning. As I turned, I saw them. One was coming at me with a huge spear, with its sharp tip pointed at my heart.
This is Bob Doty. You have been listening to American Stories and our version of A Princess of Mars. The voice of John Carter was Shep O'Neill. Our program was written for radio, produced and directed by Paul Thompson. Join us again next week for the next part of the Edgar Rice Burroughs story, A Princess of Mars, on the program American Stories on the Voice of America.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.